Okay, so here we're just gonna look at the results from yesterday's tutorial that some of the groups got. And so in this first plot, we're studying the accuracy of our neural network as a function of the number of hidden neurons that we have in the hidden layer. We just had one hidden layer in this case. And as Kfir said, these plots are basically as expected. We would expect that as we increase the number of hidden neurons and we don't change anything else, that our accuracy should increase because it should get easier to represent our data as we have more parameters in our network. Something kind of weird happened up here, but as you said, if you were to change the random seed, you'd be starting your algorithm from a different place, from different initial weights and biases. And then you said you could get rid of some of this behavior. So depending on what seed we started at, we might get stuck in different local minima.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So is it like a general solution to use as many neurons in the hidden layer as possible, or it also has its own like minuses?
I mean, if you use, there are theories that say that if you have a network with just, if you add just as many hidden units as you want, then you can basically approximate any function if you train for long enough. It could take longer to train though, maybe if you have a more complicated network.
Try to play with a different amount of neurons and kind of feeling that it's overfitting.
Exactly. So that's another problem is that that network can represent any behavior at all, right? But maybe some of the behavior that you're actually representing when you train is not what you really want to represent. And we're going to talk about that too, about sometimes yesterday you might have got results and you realize, okay, it's getting a good accuracy, but it looks like it's overfitting in some way.
But is it like a good suggestions, like how many layers I should use and how many neurons in each layer I should
It's a good question, but it's actually, this is kind of the art part of machine learning. This is kind of like one of these hyperparameters that you have to choose. So like, just like you have to choose the learning rate, today we're going to see another hyperparameter that you have to choose. Like your number of layers and your number of units in each layer, that's also kind of like a hyperparameter that in some situations you might have reasons to strongly believe, okay, I should really do it this way. And in some applications, people have, they can maybe explain some reasoning why they think they need more or less, but there's not really a
strong reasoning.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Take them out of your dimensions and this will be amount.
There's not a calculation. Like you need exactly this many, no. Yeah. Okay, so other ways that we can study how the accuracy might vary. In this case, we studied how much noise we add to our data. So in this case, as expected, this group found that as you add more noise to your data, your accuracy suffers. Again, though, they were finding that these results were not just going just monotonically as they did this. So I think in this case, that's maybe for two reasons. First of all, every time that you use a different value of noise, I guess your data set is also slightly different. So probably in this case, if we wanted to get smoother results, you'd probably have to average, have to average over seeds, but that wouldn't be, I guess it's also for getting stuck in different minima, but also because we're, just emphasizing we're using different data every time that we run this. And the last group, you guys sent me two plots. I included both because they had slightly different ranges on the x-axis. In this case, this was again studying your accuracy as a property of your data, but in this case it was as a function of the number of different branches that you had in this data set. So again, I think the trend you were finding is to be expected, that as you have more branches, so we're trying to classify a larger number of different labels, you also found that your accuracy was decreasing in this case.
The cost was increasing?
Yeah, the cost was increasing.
Yeah. Checked it at home.
Oh, okay, no, that makes sense, sorry, as a function of K. Yeah, I think that makes sense, yeah. So just to emphasize one more time that when we get some weird behavior like this, where something is jumping in here when we would really expect it to be a trend, this is maybe just, especially if we're assuming that our network is converged in these cases, this is really something that's telling us that we're getting stuck in some kind of a local minimum. And so Today I'm going to talk to you about some alternatives to gradient descent, and if you want, afterwards you can try going and applying some of these improvements to yesterday's code, and I think you'll see that it'll really help. And you'll avoid some of these overfitting and getting stuck issues that we were seeing. And so what do I really mean when I say overfitting? Here's just an example that I ran using our network with one hidden layer. I increased the noise to be pretty high, 0.5, and I used a lot of hidden neurons, so 100 hidden neurons. And you can see the network does very well. It gets almost 100% accuracy on this training data. But the way that it's classifying these regions, it's a little bit funny. So what is this for up here, for example, this feature that goes like this? This doesn't really seem very physical. This doesn't really seem that for just data that is these spirals, we wouldn't really expect it to acquire these features, especially at the top there near x2 equals 0. There's a blue point that's kind of within the purple region, and it does something really funny just to try to fit that one point. And so if we're going to try to think about this data that maybe, you know, one thing we're going to talk about is that maybe there could be some data the network hasn't seen before that we don't train it on. Well, we could assume that if we're overfitting, then our network's going to do pretty poorly if we try to test it on this data that it hasn't seen before. So we're going to talk about some ways to prevent overfitting and also some tests we can do to identify when the network is overfitting. Any questions? Okay, we can have the screen go up now. Thank you. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is talk about these alternatives to gradient descent. So the first one is called stochastic gradient descent. And as you might imagine, this one works by adding in some kind of of randomness into our gradient descent algorithm. So we have different cost functions that we can use, but a property that both the ones that we've seen have in common, as well as other ones that you might use, is that they can be written as a sum over costs on all of our data sets. So we're kind of averaging the cost on all of these data points. And the idea of stochastic gradient descent is that when we compute our gradients, which we still need to talk about how to do with backpropagation, but when we compute our gradients, rather than summing over our whole data set, we're just going to sum over some random part of it at a given time. Okay, so what we do is we introduce a term called a mini batch, which is just going to be some randomly selected subset of my data. So this is going to be capital M samples, which is going to be smaller than the number of samples in my data set. And so we're going to replace this sum over the whole data set with an approximate sum just over that mini batch. And we're going to use that to approximate the gradient in one iteration of my gradient descent. So we're going to use that to update our weights. Then when we go to the next iteration, we'll choose a different mini batch and do this again.
What is the profit of that? Just get it faster?
Faster is one. There's two big benefits, actually. So let's just, the first one you just said. So you might imagine that there could be times when we have a pretty big data set, for example. And every time we want to calculate our gradients, which means every time that we want to update the weights and biases, which is many times within our algorithm, we have to sum over the whole data set. That could be pretty expensive. So introducing a way that we could sum over a smaller number of terms and still approximate these gradients, that's a benefit of this algorithm. But the other aspect is that we're introducing some randomness into our algorithm. So, and this is gonna help, this could help prevent it from getting stuck in local minima, because we're just introducing some noise.
Jump out of the local minima.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There are like suggestions which part I should, what will, should be the size of mini batch?
That's another thing that you can play around with too.
There's
a trade-off, I guess, because you still want it to be searching for a rough minimum. So I think when you make the mini batch size too small, then you are speeding things up a lot, but then you can have cases where maybe it's not a very good approximation of your gradient. But I think a lot of people still even do that, but that can even be, then you might find that it takes a long time to find your minimum just because it's not using very good approximations all along the way. So that's another thing you have to play with.
When you do, for example, when you do the analysis with this method.
It depends on the situation, but I did do this in the tutorial. I tried it at one point, but I was playing with different ones. So. Our data set, I think, was pretty small, right? I think it was only 150 data points. I think maybe I tried like around, I varied from like 10 all the way to 50, maybe, mm-hmm. with
like,
this size.
From 10% to say 30% of the...
Yeah, or even, yeah, in the, yeah, sure, something like that, yeah. You better, yeah, want to add something?
Yeah, so a small mini batch size is pretty slow, but it's more stochastic.
Yeah.
It could be good. But that takes a really long time on big data sets and stuff. So oftentimes you see people doing batch sizes of 1,000, 2,000, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook also has a paper where they argue for the ideal mini batch size. So that might be interesting to look into.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, and when you say it's slow, I think the reason you're saying it's slow is because often when people refer to the speed, they're referring to the time to cycle through the whole data set anyway. So it's actually faster to just update the weights once, definitely. But then, as we were saying, that's actually not a very good approximation. So usually you're going to need to iterate more times than you would before. So when Matt is saying that it actually takes longer, he's saying because it takes longer to actually go through your whole data set. Yeah. So yeah, again, like when I say speed here, maybe that should be with an asterisk because that's just the speed to update your weights one time, which is maybe not a good measurement of speed in this case. Okay, then we can add momentum when we're doing this gradient descent. What does that mean? So what we do now is we just take the current state of our parameters and we update them using the current gradient. But what this algorithm does is it keeps memory of the previous gradients that we've had. So this V is this memory of these previous gradients. So this part looks similar to what we've had before, but this is not, these are not our parameters. This is this memory parameter that I was mentioning. But then we update our parameters using this V parameter now. And so you can see that every time I run this, I'm going to be keeping my previous value of this V parameter that I had before and then adding the gradient. Then the next time I run, this factor of this gradient is going to get suppressed by this gamma factor, but it's still going to be a part of this equation. So you can see previous values of this gradient are kept. Okay, so you might imagine some situation where our algorithm is, the cost function is steadily decreasing as a function of our parameters as we're in the direction that we're moving. But maybe this change is very slow. So we might find that our algorithm is progressing very slowly, or maybe getting stuck or something. So what this algorithm is going to do, it's going to ensure that these parameters actually keep changing, even when these gradients get really small and close to zero. And the way it does that is because it's also taking into account the fact that we have memory that this gradient has still been consistently changing in the same direction, v. So as long as it's been consistently changing in the same direction, even if our gradient gets pretty small, these parameters won't just stop changing and get stuck. So this is another thing that can help. Okay, and the last thing, we're not really going to talk about it in detail, but I think the idea is worth talking about. There are algorithms that adapt the learning rate. So one thing you might have noticed when looking at the formula for gradient descent is that this learning rate is going to be the same for all parameters. So yesterday, for example, for all of our weights and biases in our simple network, we were using the same learning rate. But you could imagine we could sometimes get into situations where we can learn really quickly for some parameters at a given point in time, but maybe we need to have take smaller steps for other parameters. And so these algorithms are designed to solve this issue. Thank you. Okay, so again, the learning rates in this case can change and they can be different for each of the weights and biases in our network. There's different algorithms that do this. Two examples that are often used are called the Atom Optimizer and root mean square propagation. And the cool thing is if you want to try this on yesterday's tutorial code, all you really need to do is change one line. So instead of calling the gradient descent optimizer, you can just change that line to call the atom optimizer. And TensorFlow has already coded that for you. So it's pretty easy to just give that a try. And I'm just mentioning a few of these alternatives to gradient descent, but there's others as well. So in TensorFlow, for example, if you just look up the module tf.train, you can see a more complete list of all the options we have.
Lauren?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Is it possible to I have two questions. The first is whether it's possible to combine some of those techniques, for example, learning rate change, and combine it with the very first one?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah.
And the second thing is about this learning rate change. So it's make different steps kind of for different parameters, but is it possible to change the step size for one parameter? So for example, when you see that you're going fast down, then make the step bigger, but once you see that you're kind of somewhere close to the minimum, make
yeah, and that's
smaller.
And yeah, part of this being adaptive is that it would adjust in some way to when it needs to take bigger versus smaller steps. Yeah, another thing that people often do that's simpler than doing that, which involves figuring out what step it needs, is just noticing that often when we're learning, we can learn pretty quickly near the beginning of a problem, and then as we progress, we tend to get closer to the minimum. So some people will just incorporate a learning rate with just a decay that we choose. So an exponential decay, for example, you'll start with a given learning rate and then it'll learn with a fairly big learning rate at the beginning. Then that will decay maybe exponentially, or you can use another functional dependence if you want. And that's an easier way rather than having to figure out exactly how we should adapt this.
And then if you connect that with the very first way you described, then you can also jump out the local minimum.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the stochastic gradient descent, it's very common. It's almost always used, I think, in practice, in training. And it's often combined with lots of the other methods that we're going to talk about. Yeah, good question. Okay. Bring the board down. Okay, so we've been really lucky with using TensorFlow that we really haven't had to worry about coding the details of gradient descent. And that means that we haven't really had to think much about backpropagation, but I think it's really worth thinking about and appreciating some of the subtleties of these algorithms. So we're gonna at least talk about what goes into the algorithm of backpropagation in order to calculate the gradients needed to perform gradient descent or one of these alternatives to gradient descent. Okay, so remember that we're assuming our cost function is implementing some kind of an average of costs over our data set. I always forget to put the other end of this, sorry. So actually what this algorithm is going to do, it's going to just show us a way to calculate these small c's, so the cost on each data point, and then we just simply have to average over them at the end. Okay, so we're gonna see expressions for how you can calculate the partial derivatives with respect to the cost on each individual training sample, but then you need to average over many to get the gradient of your full cost function. Okay, so just remember this notation that we saw yesterday of how we calculate the outputs from each neuron in a feed-forward network. And we're going to introduce some new notation, this delta parameter. So actually, lots of the formulas that we're going to use, they calculate this delta parameter for the different layers, and then they propagate this error throughout the layer. They propagate this quantity, sorry, throughout the layers. Okay. Okay, so as you might remember, our cost functions are usually written as a function of the output from the last layer. So our formulas are explicitly in terms of these A capital L's. So it turns out that it's easy to calculate the gradients and also this delta quantity for the last layer. So let's do that first. Thank you. So if we take this partial derivative and then we replace, we insert derivatives of this A quantity instead of this Z, what you're able to find is that this delta quantity for the last layer can be written as it involves taking the partial derivative of my cost function with respect to the output of that last layer. And then I need to know the derivative of my activation function on that layer as well. So that's that first one. That's for that last layer. And then,
sorry.
Oh yeah.
Do you think you could bring the top four to the middle? I can't.
Oh yeah, sorry, it's shiny. Yeah, for sure. Thank you for saying that. Is that better?
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and as we've kind of talked about a bit yesterday, now the idea is that now that we've calculated this quantity for the last layer, we're going to use what we found there to calculate it for the layer next to that and keep propagating this backwards. So I'm not going to go through all the details of how you calculate it. I'll show you the idea. But I would encourage you to make sure that you understand how to derive these formulas. I might put it on your homework. I haven't decided yet. Okay, so if you go through this calculation, you can show that this is what you're going to get for this delta quantity on a layer other than your last layer. Okay, can I move this one up now? Is that okay? And now it turns out that you can get your gradients that are needed for your training algorithm in terms of these quantities. And they are just written like anybody have any questions? No? Okay. So this is the idea of how backpropagation works. Again, I would encourage you to make sure you understand how to derive all of these four equations. And now I do want to proceed to talk to you guys about these issues of overfitting. But first, I think it's really worth summarizing what we've seen in the last few lectures by showing you the overall training algorithm for doing one epoch of training. So if you remember in the code yesterday, you had this loop over these epochs and you are running this many times. So what's actually really going on? How do we combine all the things that we've seen? I'm going to write kind of pseudocode on the board. So we're going to start with a forward pass. So what I mean when I say forward pass is we're just going to compute the output of our network for a given input. So, and remember that the way we compute the output is that we start from the left and then we propagate to the right in order to compute the output of our network. So first we denoted that the output of our zeroth layer is just our input. Okay, and then we just had to use this nonlinear activation function for each layer, and that would allow us to compute the output for a layer in terms of the output from the previous layer. Okay, so that's our forward pass. And then we get some output that we can compare, and we can compare that with the label that we had on our data. So then, next. Now we've passed forward, now we want to pass back using this back propagation. So, the first thing we do is we get this delta quantity for our last layer from equation one over there. And then in this way, we iterated forwards through the layers. Now we iterate backwards through the layers. And then as we iterate backwards, we keep figuring out these delta parameters from the layers that are in front of it. And then once we have those, we can figure out our gradients. And then we can finally update our parameters once we do that. So now we need to do our gradient descent or something else in order to update our weights in our network. So I'm just writing there what you would do for gradient descent, but again, you can of course replace that with one of these alternatives to gradient descent. Okay, anybody have any questions? No questions? Okay, so now let's get into talking about these issues of overfitting and some more modifications that we can make to our analysis and our training in order to prevent overfitting and identify it. So can someone remind me what I mean when I say overfitting in the context of these training algorithms?
So the algorithm just becoming perfect for training set.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it stopped being like kind of universal for this type of data.
Yeah, perfect, yeah.
Only usable for this very data set.
Exactly. So our algorithm becomes too specific to the training data that we're showing it, and it's not very general. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so if we had maybe one point that was weird, the network's gonna make some big adjustment just to fit that one point or something like that. And it doesn't really seem that that's what we would actually want it to do, because if we just change some of our data points or add a few data points, it might not work very well. Thank you. Okay, so I think a lot of you saw yesterday that you had cases where your cost function was definitely decreasing, as we hoped that it would in general. And you even had cases where your network could get close to 100% accuracy, depending on the exact parameters of your data and your network. And just to emphasize, when I say accuracy, what I mean is the percent of labels that it's getting correct. Okay, so yesterday we were talking all about designing algorithms that were going to minimize this training cost. And even though that's what we were doing, we were finding that we were getting to situations that we didn't actually want because we were overfitting. So it's a good thing to be plotting something like this cost and making sure that it's going down, because if it's not, then there's probably also something wrong in your algorithm. But now I want to talk about a few other things that we should be thinking about as well. So what we do is we take our data set and we separate it into two sections, one for training and one for testing. And the testing data is never going to be used to adjust the weights and biases in the network. So it's never used in training. So it's never going to be used to calculate these gradients and then perform this step. This gradient descent step of our algorithm. Okay, so we can have this data and we're not actually going to use it to train, but after we've performed several iterations of our training algorithm, we can still calculate our accuracy on this testing data and we can see how well it's doing. And hopefully it's still improving as we train our algorithm, at least in the beginning. Okay, and a typical plot that you might see if you were to plot this is that as we want, this test accuracy is going to initially improve. It might have a lot of noise in it. But then it's going to get to a point where it's going to saturate. And at this point, your test accuracy is no longer improving. However, if you looked at your training cost would probably still be going down. So your algorithm would keep going. But in this case, we would say we're not actually really doing any better on data that we're trying to test on, and that is important to make sure that this data is also improving in accuracy. It's not doing any better. So there's no use in continuing to train this network in this case. You could even have cases where it starts going down as well. Does anybody have questions about that? Okay. So then I'll leave the discussion of how we can actually improve our algorithms to prevent this tomorrow. There's a few methods we can talk about that we can just invoke slight modifications to the algorithms we've already seen and help to improve some of these overfitting issues. Okay, so does anybody have any questions about anything from today or yesterday or earlier?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Imagine I have a machine learning algorithm that works like unsupervised. So I can't split that one into the training and testing data, right? Because they just can't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I have to get.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about how to handle unsupervised learning next week in a lot more detail, but you're right. This, in the way I'm talking about it, this is specifically for supervised learning. Yeah. Any other questions? Oh, yeah.
For the momentum explanation,
mm-hmm.
What do we usually initialize V to be random or zero?
To be zero, because it's kind of like a running memory of this, of your previous gradient. So initially it's just zero. You just haven't seen anything before. Yeah, that's a good question. I should have written that down. Thanks. Yeah.
Do you ever have to renormalize V, like if it gets really large?
Oh, I actually don't know. I've never actually used it myself. Has anybody ever used this momentum method before? And have you ever run into cases where your V got too big?
Like the parameters of like if you keep gamma pretty low.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You always gamma, maybe I didn't explicitly write it. Gamma is another hyperparameter, right, that you'd have to play with. So you could, I guess, have yeah, so actually that's right. Like if your gamma is too big, then you're putting too much importance on these previous gradients that you've had. So in that case, I guess, yeah, you could have cases where it's becoming too big. And so you would want to take that into account. So yeah, you have to play around, I guess, with the balance between that gamma parameter and your learning rate that you're putting on new things. And you have to find the right amount. But it's another thing you have to play with in your network. Anything else? Sure. Nothing else?
I have a question, but I need to show you the picture.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, let's end for today then, and see you guys tomorrow.